We'll get this meeting of the Government Operations Committee called to order. We don't currently have a quorum, but if we can start on the bill, Representative Atkins, if you want to come down and start your bill. And House File 588. And I know this is a simple little bill. It'll only take a couple of minutes, right?
Straight to the consent calendar if we still had one, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee, Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And one thing I've learned in this process, Mr. Chairman, is that when you have good testifiers, the author doesn't need to talk a whole lot. So I will try to just kick this thing off and then leave it to the testifiers on each side to explain their positions. This, for members that have been around here for a little while, is the so-called nurse staffing bill. When previously introduced, and this is it's worth pointing out that this is considerably different. The previous iteration of the bill had fixed numbers in terms of nurse to patient staff as far as nurse to patient staff ratios. This one does not. This one simply says that we will adopt nationally accepted evidence-based staffing ratios. And the reason why that's important, Mr. Chairman, is, well, the vast majority, I think, of our hospitals are doing a fine job. In fact, Minnesota has a terrific health care system. You are about to hear, at least we did in the last committee, some really kind of terrifying stories about what's happening in certain places. If I were a patient laying in a bed and a situation arose where the worst thing is you don't even know what's going wrong. There's situations that arise where the numbers are just so far off that patient safety is in fact at risk. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that's what the bill is designed to address. I'd like you to get a little bit of background. Members get a little bit of background from the testifiers, and then we'll just reserve a couple minutes at the end to kind of give a little further description of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Atkins, Chair Atkins, we now have a quorum, so I'll officially call the meeting to order, and I'll move that House File 588 be recommended to pass. And where does this need to go from here?
I believe next is Health and Human Services Policy, Mr. Chairman.
So we'll move it to Health and Human Services Policy. And I see three amendments here. Do you want to deal with those now? Are those your amendments or?
Mr. Chairman, they are not. I think at least one of them I consider a relatively friendly amendment, but it's not an author's amendment.
Okay, well then we'll deal with the amendments after the testimony. And we'll try and get through the testimony. I have Shannon Cunningham as the first person on my list, and if people can be concise in their statements, and we'll try and hold questions till the end when all the people have testified. So, welcome to the committee, and welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Representative Atkins.
My apologies. I did have the A4 was in fact an author's amendment. It does a little bit of clarifying that we previously had indicated what we wanted to do. So I would move, or I would ask that the A4 amendment be moved.
Okay, Representatives. I'll move the A4 amendment to House File 588. Any questions on the amendment? It's an author's amendment, and all in favor of the author's amendment, A4, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Motion passes. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you for your overwhelming support for the amendment.
And welcome to the committee. And please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chairman Nelson and committee members. My name is Shannon Cunningham, and I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Nurses Association. Minnesota Nurses Association is both a professional organization and a labor union representing 20,000 of the estimated 33,000 registered nurses who work at least part-time in Minnesota hospitals. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. We're here today to specifically address the parts of the bill relative to your committee, the work of MDH in developing these guidelines, the staffing advisory committees, and the consumer transparency required in the bill in the way of reporting. However, I would be remiss if I did not assure you that, in addition to the thousands of unsafe staffing forms reported by MNA members, There are dozens of research studies that lend credibility to the fact that inadequate nurse staffing leads to increased incidence of non-fatal adverse outcomes, such as pneumonia, shock, cardiac arrest, and urinary tract infections. Studies looking at California, a state with the strictest staffing requirements in the nation, found that 30-day mortality rates in California were 10 to 13% lower than states in which than other states in which the study looked at. Another study showed that if the average patient-to-nurse ratio in hospitals in New Jersey were the same as California, there would have been 13.9 fewer surgical deaths in that state. A comparison in Pennsylvania showed there would have been 10.6 fewer surgical deaths. We all know someone who's been in a hospital. We all probably know someone who's died in a hospital. What if you or that person was one of those 10%? The first section of the bill that I know is pertinent to the committee I'd like to address is this: is the part that asks MDH to look at the standards. This bill asks hospitals to use evidence-based data to determine appropriate staffing levels at hospital facilities. It's common practice for hospitals to create staffing grids, which indicate the number of nurses needed for each shift in each unit, often using evidence-based data. In the event there is no standard, we ask the Department of Health to review evidence-based research and develop a standard in consultation with hospitals, doctors, registered nurses, and licensed practical nurses. This amendment that was just offered is a result of a recommendation by the department and a response to comments from the Hospital Association about the appearance of skewed membership on the committee. We responded by trying a new approach that is more equitable and inclusive of many of the disciplines of those who work in hospitals. An integral part of this legislation is the creation of a safe patient assignment committee at each Minnesota hospital. This committee's charge is to implement and evaluate the standards set forth by the Department of Health, track staffing trends in the hospital, and develop a procedure for making adjustments to increase or decrease staffing levels as a result of patient acuity and nursing intensity. While it may seem unusual to request 60% of the membership on this committee be made up of registered nurses, recent evidence-based research has emerged which sheds light on something we have long suspected. Nurses' knowledge and experience with problems such as staffing are often overlooked when placed alongside the financial priorities of their employers. This recent study looked at a group of hospitals in the process of setting up staffing committees with mandated direct nurse participation. When nurses try to balance their professional commitments with their responsibilities as employees, the institutional sway of the employer holds stronger and nurses become easily persuaded to adopt the institutional standpoint towards productivity that their managers are trained to have. The same study found that instead of empowering the nurses, as the staffing committee was intended, the collaboration on the staffing committee resulted in the nurses' direct care nurses' knowledge being characterized as emotional, lacking understanding of the bigger picture, having the wrong expectations, having incorrect knowledge, or even poor attitudes. As you continue to listen to testimony from the Hospital Association and hospital management, you will likely hear the same characterizations of the concerns of M&A and the direct care nurses in which we represent. The same study showed that the administrative solution to dealing with nurses who lack the bigger picture is to properly educate them and get the nurses on board with the priorities of the hospital. It's easy to understand how, when the person who's signing your paycheck tells you to get on board, you may feel inclined to let your employee side take precedent over your professional side. This phenomenon has become apparent as recent as the last few weeks when M&A members started reporting being subject to captive audience meetings held by their employers, in which they were told that the passage of this very bill would result in their hospital closing or cause them to lose their ability to give input into staffing levels at their individual hospital. Nurses were then asked to call and email legislators asking them to vote against the legislation based on that information. I'm sure each of you have received some of these calls, but I'm also sure that each of you understands that when the person who signs your paycheck has you listen to a half-hour-long presentation on the dangers of our safe staffing legislation and then asks you to make a phone call or send an email, you may feel pressured to do so. All of these experiences and the evidence regarding the co-opting of nurses on these committees show that it is essential that nurses be given a stronger presence on staffing committees in order to ensure that the resulting decisions are truly based on the best possible decisions for patients. Lastly, I'd like to address the final portion of our bill, which requires hospitals to publicly report their staffing plans and levels. It is no secret that Minnesota hospitals receive millions of dollars each year from taxpayers. With the receipt of these funds, hospitals have a heightened responsibility to ensure that they are utilizing these tax dollars to provide patients with the best care possible. We strongly believe that your constituents, all of whom are consumers of health care, have the right to know the staffing level at the hospital they choose and compare staffing levels so that they can make an informed decision about the health care facility that they are choosing. I again thank you for the opportunity to testify and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. We'll proceed with all the testifiers, and then we'll go back to questions. Lawrence Massa. And again, please state your name for the tape and then proceed with your testimony.
Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Lawrence Massa. I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association, which represents 144 hospitals and health systems in our state. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I want to speak to the reasons why Minnesota hospitals and our members oppose this bill. Three critical points stand out. First, Minnesota hospitals have been at the forefront of healthcare reform efforts, working to provide better care coordination with a team approach. Simply put, if this bill were to become law, hospitals would be forced to staff to a quota rather than implement new models of care delivery based on the needs of individual patients. Second, the bill's author and M&A say they've made significant changes in the bill from the previous year's bill. And while that's true, let me be very clear that this bill is still a quota bill. Let me explain. The bill identifies four professional organizations out of dozens of groups. These four professional associations don't agree on national standards because there are no national standards on staffing. In fact, two call for quotas and two call for flexibility. We would no more expect standards from them than we would expect the Minnesota Medical Association to say how many doctors we should have or the American Hospital Association to say how many hospitals the country should have. The bill as amended today is written so that the issue of staffing quotas must go now to the Minnesota Department of Health. The Department of Health did not provide direct patient care or know what a standard should be because there are no standards. There is no perfect number. The amendment does not change the fact that the bill takes away the staffing decision making from your local hospital by a team of healthcare professionals and puts it with people here in St. Paul. Our concern is that the bill does not say the standards would be different for different hospitals, but yet the M&A's testimony at the last hearing, its president implied that quotas would be set for each unit of every hospital in the state. I quote, "It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Standards for a hospital in Marshall will be different than those in a metropolitan hospital or even Montevideo or another small hospital." Does this mean that the department would have to talk to each and every hospital in the state to create a standard? How can the health department employees who have never laid eyes on the patients being cared for by that hospital decide what staffing is needed? This has our members very uneasy. The American Nurses Association's principles for nurse staffing emphasize the need for flexibility and to staff according to the acuity of patients as opposed to a fixed number. This legislation is not about making hospitals in Minnesota better. It is about government intervening in ways that will start to erode the quality of Minnesota's hospitals and over the long term will threaten the very existence of some hospitals. This legislation would raise labor costs by an estimated 4% per year, and that estimate was made before the amendment was added that effectively would prohibit hospitals from laying off people to accommodate the additional expense of quotas. This is at a time when Medicare, the largest single payer for hospital services, will be imposing a 2% across the board cut as a result of sequestration. Third, on behalf of all my hospitals, I want you to know how discouraging it is to be told that this legislation is needed because the quality of care we deliver is being compromised. In study after study, Minnesota's hospitals already have higher quality and patient satisfaction and lower costs than California hospitals. In 2012, Minnesota was ranked first in the nation for healthcare quality by the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality. the gold standard for patient satisfaction measures, the Hospital Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems ranks Minnesota's hospitals higher than both California and the national average on every single measure of patient satisfaction. Comparing us to California, the only state in the nation to have imposed these kinds of quotas, somehow suggests that the Golden State is the standard Minnesota should achieve. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this legislation is not needed. We are eager to continue working with our nurses and other caregivers to achieve even better patient outcomes, improve patient experience, and make care more affordable, not more expensive. We don't want to be like California. We want to be like Minnesota, the leader in quality and patient satisfaction. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Casa. And next on my list is Eric Trones. Franz? Please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Eric Tronis, and I'm a nurse at Abbott Northwestern Hospital in Minneapolis. I've been a registered nurse for 15 years. The Standards of Care Act before you calls for local safe assignment committees, safe patient assignment committees that will have significant benefit for patient care in this state. We are testifying here today that the local committees established by the M&A contract language look good on paper, but rarely result in constructive solutions for nurses as we practice at the bedside without the resources to safely care for our patients. From my own experience, I have witnessed the shortcomings of these committees, where the meetings are permeated by management's dominance. I have seen nurses berated by senior management during staffing committee meetings. I know nurses are subject to threats, intimidation, and have been threatened with possible discipline for asserting that hospital staffing is unsafe. A committee whose goals are set and whose decisions are finalized by the same hospital administrators who hold the future of our jobs in their hands, as you might imagine, is not typically productive. I can only imagine the risk a nurse without the protection of a contract takes if he or she advocates for safer patient care. We recognize the natural tension between the financial viability of a professional nurse and professional nursing judgment. Every nurse I know plays out the delicate balance to make the most economical use of our time and meet the productivity goals with the inherent dedication to meeting the needs of all our patients. But in the hospitals today, the landscape is frankly unfairly skewed toward the bottom line. Productivity invariably trumps safe nursing care. Grounding these new local committees and statutes and giving the bedside nurse the power of established statewide standards restores the weight to our professional nursing judgment and the staffing decisions made daily and shift by shift. Bedside nurses know what our patients need. We know how to deliver safe patient care. We need a venue that gives us not only a meaningful seat at the table, but established standards from which to work and the authority to make decisions based on our professional judgment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. And the next person on my list is Susan Rock. Welcome to the committee, and please again state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. My name is Susan Rock. I'm the Clinical Nursing Director of the Intensive Care Unit at Methodist Hospital. I would like to thank you for the opportunity this morning to provide you with firsthand insight into the day-to-day operations of units within a hospital. I've been a nurse for over 30 years. Most of that time has been spent providing bedside care to patients. Up until 1 year ago, I was a member of the Minnesota Nurses Association. I left M&A when I accepted my current leadership position at Methodist Hospital. I believe this proposed legislation undermines the asset most valuable to our nurses, autonomy. We trust our nurses to make the right judgment for our patients, and they deliver. Imposing rigid quotas will limit our ability to provide the best care for our patients. Scheduling caregivers in a hospital is about more than just the numbers. A unit can have the same census day in and day out, but may need very different levels of staffing and staff with different areas of expertise because of our patients. On a given day, two units may have the same number of patients, but may have very different staffing needs because one of the units has patients who are sicker, more frail, on a ventilator, or less ambulatory. My ICU may have 22 beds, and I might have 12 patients. Those 10 empty beds could be filled by the very next shift. Or Methodist Hospital may need 3 critical care nurses from 3 to 11 p.m. But by 3:30, we've had 3 ambulances arrive with new patients, and suddenly we need 5 critical care nurses. Many times a charge nurse is able to serve as a bridge, providing care for stable patients while the bedside nurse works with the patient who has greater needs. In some cases, we call upon our flying squad, nurses who are cross-trained, who are on duty, and able to respond to patients' needs as they arise. I'm very proud to say that I was a flying squad nurse for many years. Our second option is to ask for volunteers for overtime. And let me be very clear, mandatory overtime is prohibited. However, the MNA has negotiated in its contract the absolute right for nurses in order of seniority to claim overtime as the need arises and as they choose. If there is still a need, we page our off-duty nurses to determine who is able to come into cover for a shift. And finally, we can call an outside nursing agency to bring in temporary nurses. This last option is very rare. In fact, last year, Methodist turned to an outside agency for 64 total hours, less than 1% of all shifts. Nurses have it within their power at any time, on any shift, to make a unilateral decision to stop caring for new patients if they believe staffing is inadequate. Every nurse, in fact, every caregiver at Methodist, knows that as soon as they raise a concern for staffing, our entire system is designed to respond. And we do respond quickly and effectively, every day, every shift, for every patient. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. Next on my list is Julie Uslick.
Uslick.
I'm getting my vowels wrong all day on everybody today, so. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Chairman Nelson and members of the committee. My name is Julianne Uslick, and I have been a registered nurse for 37 years. I have worked at Fairview Southdale Hospital for the past 22 years, and since 2008, I have served as our union's bargaining chair at the hospital. The mechanisms that are established through our contracts between the MNA and Fairview Hospitals and Clinics were intended to create a form of communication and mutual accountability between our members and hospital management. For over 30 years, our contract has provided for a staffing advisory committee that is designed to meet monthly to, quote, review and discuss staffing matters and to provide direct input to nursing administration in formulating staffing policies and making staffing decisions, unquote. We also have, on paper, a nursing care delivery committee designated with, and I quote, authority and accountability to specify the role implementation of the registered nurse in the patient care delivery system of the organization and the application of the nursing process in that delivery of patient care, unquote. I am actually co-chair of both of these committees, and I can tell you that they have become hollow. We have presented innovative proposals, such as an idea successfully used in other metro facilities to help boost the voluntary on-call participation rate. And that idea was summarily dismissed by our director of nursing. At another meeting, we were informed, without agreement, that the position of resource nurse was being eliminated housewide. After a year, we are still using our contract process in an attempt to impede this action because we have told our management time and again that we simply do not have enough skilled nursing professionals on duty right now to keep our patients from risk. In other meetings, the agenda was dominated with management's intention to introduce and implement a hospital-wide system of conduct based on the Disney experience, which involves on-stage and off-stage behavior. Let me assure you, when I am trying to keep a patient's heart from failing again, I am not acting, and I do not have need for lessons from Mickey Mouse. We are frustrated enough in our facilities that have at least an interaction with our management through contract requirements. I cannot imagine the exasperation of my colleagues in non-contract hospitals in the state, where edicts are imposed from on high on whim. The patients in our care deserve consistency and clear, cool-headed thoughtfulness based on evidence. The standards established through this bill will act as a strong foundation for the work of the Safe Patient Assignment Committees, and they are critical to the success of the Standards of Care Act. The personnel at the table will truly be equal and empowered to act in the best interests of the patient. The reports generated by the committees would act as a valuable resource for mitigating bad behaviors and designing better systems. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony. The next person on my list is John Fossum. I think I got that one right.
Yes, you did. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is John Fossum. I'm from Ely, and for the past 15 years, I've served as administrator at the Ely Hospital. I'm accompanied today by our Chief Nursing Officer, Becky Galke. We're a critical access hospital. We serve approximately 8,000 year-round residents and many, many visitors to the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. Our nurses at the Ely Hospital are special. They're not specialists. Our nurses must demonstrate competencies across the spectrum, and they do it well. You see, we're small and we're remote. I'm here to speak in opposition to House File 588. The bill has many shortcomings, most importantly, too many long tails pretending unintended consequences. Some representatives have begun to recognize these consequences through amendments. The only outcome of this bill is the creation of mandated staffing quotas, whether by the preference of an association or a government work group, and not by members of the care team at the Ely Hospital. The most important thing I want you to understand today is that a mandated staffing quota will place the Ely Hospital in a position to either violate EMTALA regulations or the Mandatory Staffing Act. The Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act is a federal law that requires us to treat and stabilize patients in the emergency room. When the next hospital is 50 miles away, and longer when weather is bad, this legislation puts a nurse in the position of having to divert a patient to the next community or violate the staffing standards. Another tale is with our nursing home, which our hospital divested of over a year ago due to financial implications and a desire to maintain a hospital in Ely and access for our community. A mandated staffing ratio carries a threat to the nursing home that nurses that are working in that nursing home and badly needed will leave for the hospital. It also carries a threat that as we work with system-based carriers that they will look to drive more care into manageable situations or more manageable situations in large cities to the detriment of rural hospitals, costing M&A members jobs. Our Ely solution is quite simply this, and I'll close with this. We have a physician on duty 24/7. In addition, there's backup staff available through the Essential Clinic that's connected to our campus. Our nurses have access to a computerized call system. We have telephones in Ely. This call system allows us to bring in the most highly competent union nurse with seniority. Our chief nursing officer is a wealth of knowledge and experience. In life and death scenarios, she's leaned upon, and her knowledge is used. We never use her to replace M&A staff, but she should count for something in a small hospital, as should a mid-level practitioner that we employ from Chicago, who had served many years in Chicago. This expertise should be brought to bear, and isn't, under this legislation. We are in the process of implementing telemedicine in our emergency room. Does this have any value? What is the value of this with respect to the implementation of a staffing standard? Can we not improve care at reduced cost through use of telemedicine? Or should we quit and say the problem is solved by an arbitrary staffing standard, where Ely, our nurses, and our staff collectively work together? Our nurses have never been disciplined for calling in extra help in the 15 years that I've been there. When we need help, we need help. I shared with Representative Dill and Senator Bach earlier this year that I felt that this legislation could kill somebody. Because if we have to divert 50 miles, it may be too late. And we don't want to be in a position of diverting a staffing to accommodate a staffing law. We're going to take care of the patient. I thank you for your time and your attention.
Thank you for your testimony. The next person on my list is Courtney Lucht. Got that one right, too?
You did.
Getting better. Welcome to the committee, and again, state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
All right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to bring to light some of the issues we nurses face every day. My name is Courtney Lucht, and I am a registered nurse practicing at Fairview Riverside. I work in the emergency department, and our manager has stated that based on triage levels, an emergency room visit should last no longer than 90 minutes. Through a variety of channels, including our staffing advisory committee, I have reported to management that some patients are spending up to 40 hours in the ED. I've informed management that this is not uncommon to see 4 to 6 patients, many suffering mental illness or psychotic crises, sleeping overnight on ED cots. These patients are already anxious, and now they are alone, feeling ignored, likely suffering because I can't give them the level of care they deserve, and I can't send them where they need to be because there isn't enough staff or beds. At least the emergency department has some semblance of standards. My specialty nurse organization is the Emergency Nurses Association. They have established basic standards based on years of research and evidence that what works in the best interest of our patients. These standards are well followed in my department. But when I worked on a medical surgical unit, the standards seemed to be on the whim of who was in charge. Although we worked off of a staffing grid and review these yearly, who is it that's making the decision about whether changes could be made? An accountant who is looking exclusively at productivity models? Is it the chief nursing officer who can't remember the last time they had a 6-patient load for 8, 12, or 16 hours at a time? I have also seen and noted to management that schedules are being posted a month ahead of time with 10 to 15 shifts unfilled. These shifts may partially be filled by nurses that pick up over their schedule, and resulting holes are covered with available float pool nurses. We also depend on an RN flyer to act as a resource when our units are very busy. There is only one RN flyer available for each shift, and they are responsible for 7+ units. 9 times out of 10, the flyer is used to fill a hole on a unit and is not available to act as a resource. I have seen and reported to management that in professional nursing judgment, patients are at risk because hospital management refuses to provide the minimum staff they promised. They are also not being held accountable for this. The directives we hear are, don't look hurried, smile at your patients, use the script we give you, don't answer your patients when they question you how many patients are you taking care of today. These are tactics management uses to improve our patient satisfaction scores, when it is proven that patient satisfaction is in direct correlation to staff satisfaction. How can staff be satisfied when we are working day in and day out without the minimum staff to take care of our patients safely? Our staffing advisory committee is supposed to be an open exchange between management and bedside nurses. Our time and discussions are filled with processes and policy changes, not actual staffing concern. After almost 2 years, we are still trying to align our children's unit policies and procedures to contract minimums. These things take the time that we have allotted for staffing concerns, and not much gets resolved. We need to set consistent standards of care upon which every patient in the state can depend. We need an agency that will diligently research and set positive direction for the future of patient safety by establishing standards where they don't exist. We need to keep those standards alive through safe patient assignment committees established by law, which provides a level playing ground for nurses to speak up for nursing advocacy to be honored. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And the last person I have on my list is Linda Shimoleski.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, good morning. I'm Linda Shimoleski, Vice President of Hospital Operations and Chief Nursing Officer for CentraCare Health System, which includes five hospitals, St. Cloud, Long Prairie, Melrose, Sauk Center, Monticello, six long-term care facilities, dozens of clinics, and numerous specialty care services. I've been a nurse for 41 years and with CentraCare for 32 of those 41. I am here today to speak against House File 588. The impact of this legislation on the ability of CentraCare to deliver high-quality care to residents of central Minnesota would be very harmful. Since the focus of this committee is on operations, I would like to share with you realities of operations and staffing in today's hospitals. First, as my colleague at Methodist testified, this legislation would force us to schedule by headcount, not patient needs. CentraCare and hospitals throughout the state don't schedule by a formula. We schedule people. We have outstanding nurses, and we know that nurses and other members of our care team have unique skills, experience, personalities. When creating a schedule, we look at each of these attributes and put together a constantly adjusting schedule that assures not only that we will have enough nurses, but we will have the right nurses, nurses who complement each other and other caregivers on duty, and nurses who have the flexibility to meet the needs of all patients. Second, this legislation is based on the intuitive belief that more nurses mean more time each nurse can spend at the bedside of the patient. If you pass this legislation, nurses will spend less time with the patients who need them most. Let me explain. Hospitals today depend on an interdisciplinary team of caregivers. RNs work in teams with physicians, nursing assistants, emergency medical technicians, social workers, case managers, and others to assess the needs of the patient and to deliver the best possible care. Each member of the team is able to focus on the highest levels of expertise for which he or she is trained and the highest level of care delivery each patient needs. This bill would result in registered nurses doing more of the tasks that take them away from the bedside of those who need them. Patients benefit the most when a nurse has the time to interact directly with everyone in his or her care. Teams allow this to happen. Staffing quotas too often will put nurses in non-caregiving situations. The third point I want to make is the importance of flexibility. I've heard some supporters of this legislation try to draw the parallel to teacher-student ratios. Here's the difference. A teacher has a good idea from day to day how many children will be in class. Five extra children don't get off the bus one day. I schedule a hospital for a typical day, and then the atypical happens every day. An ice storm overwhelms our emergency room with car accidents or falls. Desperately sick flu victims need immediate attention. One of our smaller hospitals expects one delivery, and nature decides for three moms that day that day is the day, and then imposes complications on all of these situations. What do we do? what do we do? Yes, we call in additional staff. We empower our nurses and every caregiver to notify managers of staffing needs, and we respond. The testimonies of those supporting this legislation makes it clear that under this law, rigid staffing quotas will be imposed on hospitals. The flexibility to deliver care needed by real patients in real-life situations will be compromised. I have spent my entire career in healthcare. I am a registered nurse who cares passionately about the profession of nursing. I am a professional who is absolutely committed to delivering the best care for every patient, every day. I urge you to reject this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, just so we have a roadmap here, I've got three people right now on my list, and you're one of them. And I'd like to get this voted on by 5 minutes after 11, so if we can get our questions done and move this along, we've got two other bills up. So anyway. So Representative Dzikowski, I think you're the first person I saw earlier, and then I got Representative Pepin. And then you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to organize my thoughts here. I was the first testifier we had.
Ms. Cunningham.
Ms. Cunningham, yes. She said something that kind of caught my attention. I wanted to ask her more about it. She talked about co-opting of nurses on these committees. I'm curious what she meant by that. Is she still here?
Ms. Cunningham? And Ms. Cunningham, did you hear the question?
I did not. I would appreciate it if you would repeat it.
Representative Dzikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cunningham, in your testimony, you talked about co-opting, quote, co-opting of nurses on these committees. What did you mean? I didn't quite catch the full context about it. Sounded like, anyway, go ahead.
Ms. Cunningham.
And I think the report I was referring to was talking about when you have an unequal dynamic. So if you have a, you know, your boss in the room and they're asking you to do something, there's sort of an unequal relationship right there that often in any profession, but also in nursing, causes individuals to feel a little bit more pressure to do what essentially the institution is asking them to do as opposed to what they may necessarily feel is right for the patients.
Representative Dzikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cunningham, who is the boss in that situation? Is it you or the boss?
Is it what?
Ms. Cunningham.
Sorry.
Representative Dzikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Cunningham, who is in the position of authority in that situation? Is it you or the boss?
It would still, I mean, I believe your boss would always be your boss, no matter what situation that they are in. And so, and on these staffing committees, we find that, you know, a nurse is still the employee and the boss is still the employer.
Representative Dzikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Ms. Cunningham, you know, it sounds like your first statement was challenging, or maybe not recognizing that fact, and so I struggle with that. But appreciate you talking through that with me, and I hope the boss is a person in the position of authority, but apparently. Sometimes in the discussion and your experiences, you have questioned that. So I appreciate you sharing that.
All right. Thank you. Sorry, I'm a little bit out of it today, so I do appreciate your patience.
Ms. Cunningham. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Atkins, I'm trying to, I guess, work through and understand the A4 amendment and how that works with it. So my understanding is under Subdivision 3, when staffing would be determined with nationally accepted evidence-based standards as identified by the Department of Health, established by professional nursing specialty organizations. And one of the testifiers mentioned that there really are no national standards. So if you could walk me through that, because apparently if there are no national standards, then the Department of Health would have to come in, and then maybe you can work me through how they're going to figure that out by hospital. So I guess my first question is, how many units would have national evidence-based standards? Is there something you could pass out that would show us what those national standards are? Because I got from the testimony that there really aren't.
Representative Atkins. And Representative Pepin, and thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the question, because, and I've actually, as folks have been testifying, have been trying to take down some of both their comments and concerns that they've raised, just like we did in the last committee, as we try to listen and figure out what the concerns are about the bill. We're doing our best to try to accommodate some of those concerns. And one of the points that was made by several of the testifiers in the last committee, and actually was made now in this committee, I believe they may not have seen the amendment, because it was in the initial version we had a reference to certain organizations that would be used. And as one of the testifiers pointed out, some of them don't agree on how necessarily to go about this. So what we needed to find was somebody, and who better, at least in Minnesota, than the department itself, to take a look at what those various entities are coming up with. And then using, as to the extent that there is evidence-based research, and there is, and develop a standard then for those units. And in doing so, they would consult with the four groups in the very least. I suspect that the Department of Health would consult with anybody that the Department of Health wanted to consult with to try to come up with those standards. Because what we heard in the testimony today was that we have, and obviously we've got some folks who are doing a very good job, but we've also got some situations that are downright scary, and it would be ideal to figure out a way to address those, maybe take the best practices that are out there and apply them using these sort of standards that the Department of Health would provide, to bring up those that are putting folks in, putting patients in a less than safe situation on occasion.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins. So based on that, nationally accepted evidence-based standards, you said that, you know, there's not a lot of agreement. So how many of the various hospital care units actually have nationally accepted evidence-based standards? Is it zero? Is it four? Is it... Maybe you could help me with that.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, there may be folks in the room that are better able to talk about the exact number. There are nationally accepted and evidence-based studies that look at this issue. But to the extent that there's folks that have more familiarity with it, I'd call upon them.
Maybe we could get Mr. Massa up, because I think he's the one that talked about that. So
Mr. Massa,
he could explain that a little bit more.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we don't believe that there are any hard and fast national standards that have been adopted by these organizations. These professional organizations make recommendations, they create guidelines. Many of them are used by our hospitals as they're creating their staffing plans. They certainly have looked at those kinds of things, but to imply that they're a national standard that Medicare or that the Joint Commission or other accrediting organizations would look to, that simply doesn't happen from our point of view.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Massa. That's helpful, because if that's true, then I'm not really sure why that subdivision 3 is even in there, because it seems to me then that it would be the Department of Health. And then, so my question then would be, how is the Department of Health going to set quotas for every hospital? Are they going to send someone out to find out? Because I think in one of the previous testifiers mentioned that at a different committee hearing, they said it wasn't going to be a one-size-fits-all, that they're going to be, they're going to look at each hospital. So if it's the Department of Health doing this, are they going to go into every hospital and set a quota for each hospital? I'm trying to figure out how bureaucrats in St. Paul are going to come in and they're going to know better than the hospital administration as to how to best staff the hospital. So if you could explain kind of how the Department of Health is going to find the quota for every hospital, that would be helpful.
And Representative Atkins, I see somebody else that came down to the table. If you could identify yourself, maybe she can shed some light. If you can state your name for the tape and Then maybe you can answer the question.
My name is Carol Diemert. I'm the nursing practice specialist at the Minnesota Nurses Association. And there are specific standards on most of the specialty organizations. And if they're not specific, they're very clear guidelines. And these are all established by nurses in those specialties. For example, critical care, operating room, women and children for OB. These are set, and many hospitals do use them. That's true. But there's not, I'm getting the impression that making it look like they're really absent of standards. That's absolutely not true. They're right that some of them are more specific than others, but these are all done by the specialists in the nursing area, and they're the best available evidence-based standards that are there. And the ones that are most absent are the medical surgical units, where there's a lot of variety and types of patients of acuity and intensity. So I don't want to leave the impression that there's absolutely no standards. The health department would have a lot of guidance around what professional standards are in specialty areas.
Thank you. Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But Representative Atkins, I'm not sure that explains exactly how those quotas are going to be set, if they're standards, but it's not going to be a one-size-fits-all approach. How do we know the hospital in Ely? How does the Department of Health decide what the quota is there if they're not going to look to the administration?
And Mr. Chairman and Representative Pepin, I don't think necessarily, and you, I appreciate the fact that you believe this will result in quotas. You've made that point and used the word, I think, seven times in the last 3 minutes. The point is to set minimum standards that need to be met. And I would invite the folks from both the hospital side and the nurse side to sit down and talk about that. As Mr. Massa referenced, and he said, in our opinion, there is no hard and fast standard. I get that, but there's plenty of evidence-based studies out there that would inform this decision. And that's what I'd expect our folks at the Department of Health working with hospitals and nurses to come up with.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Atkins. I mean, to me, this is a very scary bill because it's looking like you're having the nurses run the place, decide, make the decisions, and I don't understand why, as one of the testifiers mentioned, Minnesota's got one of the lowest cost and highest quality hospitals in the country, and so I don't understand why we'd want to take the flexibility away from the professionals who've been doing that for years and have one portion of the hospital basically have the control over deciding it. As the last testifier said, there's case managers, nursing assistants, there's doctors, nurses that are all part of the care team. And what I don't understand is if just because there's 10 patients in a hospital, it doesn't mean that they have the same level of acuity needed. And I don't understand how a quota, number 8, can determine what the acuity of care is. I just don't understand why we would want to take the flexibility away. And then, you know, and Representative Atkins, that another part of the bill that is just a huge concern to me is Subdivision 7, job retention. I just don't know how a hospital is going to do that. No hospital employee shall be laid off as a result of the implementation of this. So you're going to make staffing quotas, but then you can't. The hospital is also not allowed to make changes in other areas. And you could comment on this too. I'd heard from a constituent, or I can't remember who, someone that was talking to me about this, that in California, as a result of them implementing something similar, what happened was the nurses ended up, because you can't, if you can't have any control over your staffing, the nurses then end up doing things like emptying out the trash or doing things that maybe a lower level position would do. Are you tying your shoe, Representative Atkins?
I am. I'm sorry.
All right.
I'm still listening. I wasn't getting sick or anything.
That's fine. There's a nurse here. There might be a nurse here to help.
I'm in good shape.
There might be a nurse here to help. So I mean, are you concerned at all that the nurses won't be operating to the highest level of their ability when we put this in place? Because if we can't lay off any other employee, I mean, the hospital has got to survive. So it's going to have to make decisions, and if it's going to have to make nurses replace all the other necessary positions in the hospital, it seems like nurses are going to have to do jobs that are not working up to the full potential of their ability, or jobs that they're not properly qualified for. And I'm just wondering if you've got any concerns about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Pepin, for raising a concern about the California version of this, because that's specifically why we changed the bill. so that we wouldn't demand hard quotas, but rather set standards that would be necessary to be met, because clearly we have a problem. Testifier after testifier in this committee and elsewhere have indicated that there are situations that arise, and they arise with the scary level of frequency. And the idea of setting minimum standards to protect patient safety, I think, is I'm actually a little surprised at the level of opposition to that. I think it might be a concern about what that may ultimately yield. And that's why we invite the hospitals to work with us to have that discussion to try to figure out how best we can set these standards. We've already listened to their testimony in the last committee and made the A4 amendment in response to that, because we are trying to figure out something that works. And as I think Mr. Fossum said, you know, we want to find a system where Ely, our nurses, and our community can work together to come up with a solution. I just expand that to Minnesota. I don't think we want to leave anybody behind. And if what's working well in Ely can be applied elsewhere and help others work in a better fashion too, I think that would be great. But that's the sort of discussion that we hope to have at a professional level between the nurses and the hospital.
One more, Representative Pepin, and we have other questioners.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins. Well, this may be a solution in your mind. I guess I'm not clear what the problem is, because we've got the best hospitals in the country, and part of that, I believe, is because they have the flexibility to look at the staffing needs each day to figure out which patients they have and how many nurses are acceptable. And by having bureaucrats from the Department of Health who probably know very little about this, not in the field, trying to make these decisions, and then saying that no other employee shall be laid off. So apparently we're going to have to hire more staff to make these, or to have more nurses working to make these quotas, whether or not the patients, the patient level is there on a given day. I think this might be the second scariest bill this year. The first one would have been the one that you carried on Monday night, Representative Atkins. I'm kind of wondering if you're going for the number one and number two of bad bills this year, in my opinion. But anyway, thank you so much for your indulgence. I know you've been working very hard on the two bills. And Mr. Chair, I would just ask for a roll call.
Roll call has been asked for. We'll do a roll call when we get to vote. On that, on the bill, or on amendments as they come up?
Just Mr. Chair, and the bill at this point.
Okay.
Are we on an amendment right now?
Not yet, no.
Okay.
Representative Dill, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a question. I want to share with the committee. Having served here 11 years and having a legislative district that is bigger than 8 states in the United States of America, I've got a lot of hospitals up there. And I have not once heard from a single patient, a single nurse, or a single hospital in a rural setting the need for this. However, I also am near a city my district doesn't include the city of Duluth, which is a city of the first class, a metropolitan city. And I have heard from patients that are served in that metropolitan setting, and I have heard from nurses that serve in the hospitals in that metropolitan city the need for this. So it's a very conflicted bill for me. And I just want to tell you that every single administrator in the critical access hospitals across this district larger than 8 states has told me that they are worried that should this have consequences that we hope are unintended, that you could literally have someone die because they had to send them to another hospital. Now, Mr. Fossum told you 50 miles from Ely. Thank you, Mr. Fossum, for coming down from Ely. I was able to call him on the telephones that do work up there. It isn't 50 miles down an interstate if you're going from Big Fork to the next closest hospital, or from Ely to the next closest hospital. It's down 169 in the case of Ely. And 50 miles isn't at 60 miles an hour, because you can't average anywhere near that kind of speed on that highway, particularly in the wintertime. So we're talking about transfer times between critical access hospitals to a hospital that isn't a critical access of well in excess of an hour. Recently we had an accident up in Coochin County that put 4 people ultimately in air ambulances, 2 jets that went to Fargo and 2 prop King Airs that went to Duluth. Not once did I hear from a patient, a patient's family, or from the hospital administrator, or from a nurse, saying that that kind of emergency of that magnitude caused a problem with staffing levels? They were able to manage that internally and make it work in these small settings where they've coordinated well for this. But again, I want to reflect that in the larger city of the first class, I've heard the opposite story. So I just wanted to share that with you. This state is not all one. It doesn't all have the same. And you know that I have a very good union voting record, and I've been endorsed by the Minnesota Nurses Association. But things just don't always work everywhere in the state in the same way. And so I'm hoping that at some point there's going to be an amendment come forward to exempt the critical access hospitals.
Representative Pugh, and I've got Representative Pugh and Representative O'Driscoll, and so Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Like Representative Dill, I just have comments to make, and I would just like to start by saying that I'm very opposed to this bill. My first comment, and again, kind of sorting through my notes here, started with Ms. Cunningham's presentation. I believe I have her quote to the best of my ability. I took it down: the thousands of incidents reported by MDH nurses, which will result in unsafe conditions. I'm not certain if that was, in fact, I'm assuming that that's not from specific to Minnesota, but I'm just really questioning how that would apply to Minnesota nurses. That, you know, again, I think it was to several people's comments, we just haven't heard of these issues. And the next point that I would want to make is that I have spoken with countless healthcare providers, nurses, who have called me from their breaks, who have called me from home after their shifts. I've spoken with several hospital administrators, and to a person, each and every one of the people that I spoke with who expressed their concerns, and no, Representative Atkins, they weren't here testifying, I don't believe, but I've spoken with far more individuals, just myself, than the number of testifiers that have been here. And to a person, they are against this legislation, so I'm here speaking up on their behalf today. I also have friends who are MNA nurses who have shared with me for some time, long since before I became a legislator, that they don't believe that the agenda of the MNA is that of patient care, and that there are other, ulterior motives to, I don't know that I would go so far as to say that, but that they're concerned about this as well. I heard what several of the testifiers said. I'm really struck by Mr. Massa's comment, and he spoke to quotas as well, that this is not a one-size-fits-all approach is what I wrote down. And secondly, just a huge respect for Mr. Fossum, and it struck me how he said this could kill someone. This legislation could kill someone. This is, that comment was consistent with what I heard from several of the people that I spoke with over the phone. And then just to summarize, of the testifiers today, Nurse Linda, I didn't catch her last name, but I think she just really sounded the alarm as an experienced nurse. So, and lastly, I just want to say that of the numerous people that I spoke with, I am not a medical professional, but I have an experience that is in some way analogous to this. I was a manager at Dayton's, the general manager of a Dayton store, but for 17 years. And I had responsibility for, at any point over 10 of those 17 years, for 400 employees and a management team of anywhere from 25 to 40. And I was responsible for the bottom line. So it was imperative that we, of course, at Dayton's, were delivering service to the level that customers expected. Now, I know that's not analogous to, delivering, medical care. But nevertheless, the service levels that I needed to provide in the oval room were different than that of the restaurants, were different than that in the candy department. And it was up to me as the general manager to be able to deploy, the resources that I have were collaboratively with my team in order to achieve those service standards. And again, I know I don't want to minimize this. This is, this is life or death here. But I really do think that that respect and serious consideration needs to be given to the management of the hospitals who are doing best by their constituencies. So thank you.
And that there was that wasn't a question there. And just to remind people that the reason this bill is here was about the setting up of the working group here. The amendment took the working group out. If this amendment had been put on in a different committee, this bill wouldn't have even been here. And for the people that are asking a lot of questions about health care and issues, this is going to the health care committee, so those should be asked there. And with that, I'd like to get this voted on here before at 10 after. So, Representative Duskowski, you had your hand up, and hopefully it's to the bill and to our jurisdiction here on the bill about the working group, which is no longer in the bill.
Well, I'm hopeful that that's the case, Mr. Chair.
I forgot you. I'm sorry.
Representative Atkins, this bill should be titled the Nurses Union Bill rather than a Standards of Care Act. I'm surprised that there's not a logo on the front of it, but as we look at this bill, I look at the language on 3.4 and the discussion I had with Ms. Cunningham earlier. 3.4 through 3.6 says a direct care registered nurse may not be disciplined for refusing to accept an assignment if in good faith and the nurse's professional judgment the nurse determines that the assignment is unsafe for patients due to patient acuity and nursing intensity. Representative Atkins, I agree with Representative Pepin. This is the second most extreme bill I've seen in the legislature, and you carried the first one here a few weeks ago. This provision encourages insubordination within the hospital itself. I don't really understand why we would put something like that in a bill like this. Secondly, I look down further on page 3 and see that at least 60% of the membership is guaranteed to be registered nurses. I don't know what it means on line 3.15 where it says collective bargaining appointed members to proportionately represent its nurses. I don't know what that means, and I don't know how it relates to the item above it where it says 60% must be registered nurses. So I don't know if you have any comments on that.
And Mr. Representative Atkins, those are a little bit outside of our field, but if you make it quick, I have another question here.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Duskowski. First, if you want nurses to provide unsafe or work in unsafe assignments, I guess that's your point of view. Comment. I think the nature of the bill is clear. It says at least 60% of the membership must be registered nurses who provide direct patient care.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't finished.
Make it quick. Representative Duskowski, make it quick, please.
Well,
the questions you're asking are not part of setting up the work group. And again, as I pointed out, the amendment that went on, the author's amendment, actually takes that out. And so the rest of the bill is not part of our jurisdiction. So,
is the Safe Assignment Committee not part of our jurisdiction, Mr. Chair?
No.
Mr. Chair, just a few more comments as I look at the bill here. Items 3.16 or 3.17 belongs, Representative Atkins, in a labor agreement. We're basically locking in here. It says hospitals must compensate registered nurses who are employed by the hospital and serve on the staffing for Safe Patient Assignment Committee for time spent on committee business. That belongs in a labor agreement rather than in Minnesota state statutes. I look at the bottom of page 3. We are turning the direction and around staffing assignments on that part of the bill over to this committee. They will implement and evaluate the standards provided in Subdivision 3. They will convert the national standards into nurse hours of care per patient. They'll develop a procedure for making shift-to-shift adjustments when such adjustments are required because of acuity or nursing intensity. And then on the back page, on page 4, We even go to the point where we say that if after this union committee doesn't, after they develop these plans, if the hospital doesn't follow what this union nurse committee develops, that the government will sanction the hospital. On the bottom of page 4, Representative Atkins. This is, I thank you for bringing this extreme bill forward. I'd like to rename it the Minnesota Nurses Union Bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I provide a little bit of additional background information because I had the opportunity, as is Chair Nelson and Representative Atkins, to talk about this bill back in the labor, workplace, and regulated industries. And a question that I had asked, and we were kind enough to have someone from the Minnesota Department of Health come forward, and the question I asked at that time was, do you, as the Department of Health, have any information as to the number of complaints that have been shared with them from the local hospitals or regarding staffing and patient care? And the testifier at that time said that she didn't know and that they would have someone get in contact with me. And late Sunday night, I received an email from Matthew Coley, and I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, the legislative liaison from the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm going to paraphrase some of this, and it's going to still stay in the context of what his response is. He says that the Minnesota Department of Health's Office of Health Facility Complaints investigates complaints under Minnesota law. And the part that I think is most important in here says, this would include nurse staffing working at hospitals. All complaints are reviewed and then triaged, which I think is a great word since we're talking medical at this point, according to the documented patient harm or potential for harm, with the most egregious assigned an on-site investigation. And he concludes by saying, there is no tracking code that would delineate the number of complaints about nursing staff. I thought it was important, since I was asked in the labor workplace, that this committee also hear, because I think that's within the purview of what we're talking about with the staffing committee, because the question goes, do we even have a system in place that already deals with this? And I thank the Department of Health for sharing that with us, because it does look like the state has something in place already.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. And Representative Falk, you have an amendment that you wanted to put on?
Thank you.
And is that the A6 and the A7 look similarly close?
They look the same. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the A7 amendment, but I have an oral amendment to incorporate into it. And if Mr. Shepherd is prepared, I would incorporate into my amendment striking line 1.5. And on line 1.4, after the second comma, strike must need and insert are exempt from, so that line 1.4 would read designated under section 1.44.1483, comma, clause 9 are exempt from the requirements of this section. Mr. Shepherd, do you have that?
Mr. Shepherd?
Yes.
He's saying yes.
Okay.
And you want to explain what this does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this would be an exemption for the critical access hospitals, and critical access hospitals are 25 beds and less. And I want to preface this by saying that I do think that Representative Atkins is doing a good job. I know he's a skilled legislator in bringing this forward. I have a little bit of concern about the process here. I wish this would have been heard in Health and Human Services area before, because I really think that's where a lot of the discussion should take place. And I'm going to say that there's a challenge here. I'm not going to call it a problem, but I do hope that both MNA and MHA can sit down and try to figure out some areas where they can agree. And there's a process we have to work, and I know that we took out part of the bill that deals with our jurisdiction, so I feel that there's a lot more that needs to be done on this, but this is maybe not the place to do it.
It's going to health afterwards.
Yeah, so I would move the A7 amendment as amended. Would move the A7 amendment as amended.
Representative Atkins, how do you feel about the amendment?
He's wrecking my bill, Mr. Chair. No, I appreciate the Representative Falk's comments, Representative Falk, I kind of share your thoughts. I would have liked to have actually gone to Health and Human Services policy first, but you know how the committee process goes sometimes. And I would. For purposes, I can support this amendment, Mr. Chairman, and would recommend a green vote on it. I do want to reserve, and I feel compelled to say to the folks from rural Minnesota that there are possibly a couple more committee stops for the bill, and those specifically deal with health issues. It wouldn't surprise me, and I say this as a with respect to those, I don't want to have folks, if the amendment goes on, think, okay, well, we're free and clear, nothing's going to happen to us, and nothing. So I'm saying this for the record and for the folks in the room, that they be aware that sometimes in future committees things can happen. I would suspect that there may be additional discussions about rural hospitals and about critical access in particular, and about systems or requirements that would potentially apply. I honestly don't know if that's going to happen. I just don't want to have folks come out with misunderstandings about the committee process here. And Representative Falk, I know you can say the same thing, but I just, with a bill like this, sometimes we see changes all the way to the House floor or the Senate floor and that kind of thing, and I want to make sure that we're fair to people in terms of their expectations.
Representative Pepin, you had a question to the amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Falk, I might have missed the first part, but I think that you said delete must meet and then insert are exempt from. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mr. Chair, Representative Falk, then to me it reads that they're exempt from the requirements beginning July 1st, which to me would mean that...
I deleted line 1.5.
You deleted line 1.5. That was the part I was missing. Where's that at? Oh, okay. That's the part I missed. Then I do have a question for the author, or actually either Representative Falk or Representative Atkins.
Go ahead with your question.
How many hospitals would be exempt under this, if either of you know?
Mr. Chair, I'm not certain of the number of critical access hospitals in the state. Once again, Representative Dill might have the number, but once again, this is a question I think we should be talking about in Health and Human Services Committee versus Government Operations Committee.
Representative Pepin.
Thank you. It looks like somebody here has the answer to that.
There are 79 critical access hospitals out of about 140. I should point out to the committee that not all rural hospitals are critical access, so we're creating yet another tail, getting sort of the cart out before the horse here. I appreciate the amendment as a critical access hospital, but I know that there are other hospitals that are going to be greatly affected by this.
Thank you, Mr. Possum.
John Possum.
Thank you, Mr. Possum. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I want to just echo Representative Dill's comments, too, that I have not had complaints in my district with the rural hospitals with respect to staffing ratios, but I do also share the sentiment that we do have some concerns in some of the cities of the first class, and I do think that it would be appropriate to talk about those things in the appropriate committee, and knowing that we're not that committee, it's good to have those discussions where they're relevant and appropriate.
So all in favor of Representative A7 amendment as it was modified by Representative Falk, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted. And on the bill then, the A6 amendment, I think this gets rid of the A6 amendment, so because they were identical. On the bill, a roll call has been asked for. I'll renew my motion that House File 588 be recommended to pass and referred to the Health and Human Services Policy Committee as amended. Thank you. And the roll call has been asked for. The clerk will take the roll.
Nelson?
Aye.
Freiberg?
Yes.
Pepin?
No.
Dill?
Yes.
Dorholt?
No.
Juskowski?
No.
Falk?
Yes.
Hansen?
Yes.
Kahn?
Pass.
Lean?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
Pugh?
No.
Sanders?
No.
Tice? Winkler?
Yes.
Back to Kahn.
Kahn?
Kahn votes yes.
Um, 8 ayes and 7 nays. The bill passes, and
thank you,
be on your way.
Chair and members, appreciate your time today.
The next bill on our agenda is House File 548, Representative Moline. Welcome to the committee. And if you can be quiet, please, members, please be quiet as you're exiting so we can get to our next bill. And Representative Moline, you have I'll move House File 548 to pass and be re-referred to Capital Investments. And Representative Moline, if you want to describe your bill, and I think you have some testifiers.
Yes.
If they can come down and... Representative Moline?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, and I think my testifiers are just probably trying to make their way down here. It's too bad everyone's leaving. They're going to miss hearing this exciting bill. But, Mr. Chair, you should know that I'm here to bring people together. I have both the union and the companies here to testify in favor of the bill.
Why don't you describe what your bill does, and then while your testifiers are working their way down.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My bill is House File 548. It's pretty self-explanatory, but what it does is require that contracts...
If you want to come down to the floor, yeah, you can sit.
Contracts for public works that are financed by state appropriations or local or state tax revenue must require American-made steel products be used in that construction. As some members will know, in the past, when we've passed big bills like the Viking Stadium and the Twins Ballpark, that we have attached amendments to those bills requiring that American-made steel is used. Instead of having to do it piecemeal, I brought forward the idea of just applying it to projects that use taxpayer money. And that, of course, is to ensure that taxpayer money is going to creating Minnesota jobs and American jobs instead of going overseas to bring in products. We don't make steel here in Minnesota, but, of course, the products that go into the steel come from the Iron Range. And that's why I have some steel workers here to talk about their jobs and how this will be important to them. And then we also have a representative from the Iron Mining Association here to testify for the bill. And members should also have a letter in their packet from U.S. Steel Corporation in support of the bill. We know that bonding bills and investment in public infrastructure creates jobs. I got some information from the Alliance for American Manufacturing that says that when you add provisions to bills that also require you use domestic sourcing in those projects, that it actually increases the job growth by 33%. And that's, of course, because we're getting domestic product rather than foreign product in the construction. So I have with me John Rebovich and Cliff Toby from Keewatin Taconite here to testify.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name before you testify for the tape and begin with your testimony. And if you can keep it short so we can get on with the bill and get to questions, that'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. My name is John Rebovich. I am a third-generation steelworker, born and raised on the Iron Range, and proudly say that our family has mined iron ore for over 70 years. A sound step towards growing our manufacturing sectors to take advantage of the purchasing power of the federal and state procurement by maximizing the amount of domestic steel content used in construction of public works projects. Buy American laws are effective, common sense, trade compliant, and extremely popular way to support American steel companies and their workers. Put simply, it makes absolutely no sense to send our hard-earned tax dollars to China and other countries when companies here at home are ready to do the work. Reinvesting tax dollars into local and national economies promotes growth, expands the tax base, and by hiring workers, reduces the burden on social safety nets. Mr. Chairman and committee members, as you probably know, iron ore is the first process of making steel. And we have been in Minnesota for many, many years, and a great way to support the steel industry and the iron ore industry and keep it vibrant up on the Iron Range is to support this bill. Thank you.
And then Mr. Toby, again, state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony and as quickly, as short as possible.
I'll make this quick. I'm Cliff Toby. I'm also a third-generation miner from the Iron Range.
I came down today to urge you to pass HF 548, as I believe this is exactly the kind of bill Minnesota steelworkers need in order to not only continue to mine on the Iron Range, but also to expand mining and the family sustainable jobs at these mines. I work as a mechanic at U.S. Steel's Keytec plant in Keewatin, and I've seen firsthand the effects of imported steel. In 2009, I was laid off at as Keytec was idled for almost the whole year, and I believe... believe me, I would have rather been working. At Keytec, we have an $800 million expansion that's all teed up and ready to go, yet it's on hold due to a softened demand for iron ore, which is a problem this bill could very well help to alleviate. In closing, I again urge you to pass HF 548 for the good of the American steelworkers and us Iron Range miners. Thank you.
Thank you, and I got Craig Pagel. Please state your name for the tape.
Craig Pagel, I'm the president of the Iron Mining Association of Minnesota. Thank you, Chair. The iron mines of northern Minnesota and all the people that supply the products and services to the mines also support this bill. And I think while it's good to point out all the great things that iron mining does for the state of Minnesota, a year and a half, 2 years ago, there was about $46 million that went to K-12 education and University Trust Fund. And I know there's one representative here that would be happy to hear that this last year, royalties alone were over $50 million to the state's education. That doesn't include money that comes in from the production tax that gets spread around the state as well. But we are facing some difficult times that these gentlemen next to me, they're the ones who do the work. They have generations of iron mining. I'm known as a pack sacker. And they can explain what that is probably, but kind of think of it as a carpetbagger. But the reason I speak to you today is we are fighting imports coming from China, where not only do they undercut our prices, but the global pollution that they produce affects the state, and we have to try and take care of our part of it as well as we try to help. So I would ask your support of this bill, not just for the workers, but for the whole state.
Any questions on the bill? Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, Mr. Chair, since I was indirectly referenced in the comments by Mr. Pagel, I will shamelessly give a promotion for the school trust lands that he's referring to here in the state of Minnesota and what a benefit those are to the kids in the great state of Minnesota.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moline, this is going to include all our local and state government contracts. How are we going to pay for this?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Druskowski. The bill does include a provision that if the cost of the product were to exceed 15% of getting that same product from China or India or some foreign import, that there would be a waiver in having to buy American. The 15% is actually substantially lower than a number of states have, and actually lower than the federal requirement. The federal requirement is there has to be a 25% difference in price in order to get the waiver. So I think my bill is reasonable. It's aimed at making sure the taxpayer dollars are spent on American jobs, not Chinese jobs.
Representative Druskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know, Representative Moline, you might want to look at the language. As I read that, that would include every project. But, Mr. Chair, Representative Moline, I'm wondering, is there a fiscal note or a local impact note for this?
Well, Representative Druskowski, it's going to capital investments, and they're the fiscal committee for this. We're not a fiscal committee.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just an observation. This is the second union-sponsored bill in a row today. Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, just for clarification, Mr. Pagel isn't here representing the unions, and there is a letter from U.S. Steel in your packet. As I stated, I'm here to bring everyone together. Both the union and the employer are supportive of this bill.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe to Representative Druskowski's comments, I would also just say that I do think it's important to be promoting jobs here, and I do think that maybe part of the competitive advantage that some of these other countries have is because they manipulate their currency. And so we're not playing on a fair playing field. And I think as we're shipping dollars over there and jobs over there, we should be looking at what we can do back home. And And oftentimes we see that they have so much cash built up that they end up deploying it in a lot of places over here, and sometimes we don't always see the long-term implications of that. So it's not just, you know, simple dollars to dollars, dollars and cents comparison, because their currency is, I think, significantly undervalued.
Thank you. Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Something that I'd like to just ask Representative Moline about. Two things. We had seen, and I realize that this isn't part of the committee, we saw a more broad definition this morning of public agency in labor, workplace, and regulated industries, and it included things like port authorities and others, and I noticed that your bill doesn't have that. And one of the things that this committee and others are going to be considering is the Mayo Clinic's request for Destination Medical Center. I don't know that they would be included in here. Is your intentions to exclude them, or or is that an oversight, or is the language not comprehensive enough to take in? That one's looking at having a large amount of public relief on that.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Driscoll, I will admit that I'm not that familiar with the specifics of the request from Mayo Clinic. My bill includes public agencies. The Mayo Clinic is a private entity. Now, if there's going to be a public entity acting as the fiscal agent in that project, then yes, they would be required to use American-made steel.
And Representative O'Driscoll, have that bill, the state dollars that would be going into that are infrastructure work that would be done by the city of Mankato, or excuse me, Rochester, get the right city, and the Mayo's going to be doing their investment in their private enterprise, the money that we would be going if they meet their requirements for additional revenue would be in the public sector side. Representative O'Driscoll.
Mr. Chair, your point is well made, and the only reason I raise that issue is we were told that that's modeling after port authority type language to create that entity. I would suspect that there would be steel products that might be used in that, but port authorities are not itemized in here. We talk about local municipalities and counties and others, and so I just ask Representative Moline if, as she's considering this bill, if she wants to include those kinds of entities as well.
Representative Lean, it might be something to look at.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative O'Driscoll, if you wanted to add the amendment to include Port Authority, I'd be willing to do that, or we can take care of it in the next committee.
Mr. Chair, my suggestion to the author of this bill is to talk to the author of the other bill, Representative Norton, and see if you can come to a workable understanding on that.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lean, do American steel products include those recovered from recycling?
Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen. Mr. Pagel just whispered into my ear that yes, it does, and 90% of products are recycled now.
Any further questions? If not, I'll renew my motion that House File 548 be to pass and be referred to Capital Investments. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes. The bill is, or the motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Moline. Okay. And Representative Earhart, we are past our time, so we'll continue this on another agenda, because our time is up. And with that, did we do the minutes? We don't have minutes again today. Okay. Motion's adjourned. Meeting's adjourned.